Author of the Week, featuring another great creator of narratives for the human race on Southside Broadcasting and Siren Radio.
The three-letter acronym EDI is something you may have heard of. Then again, you may not have. Maybe if I mentioned diversity and inclusivity, you might groan. You might think, what's going on here? What about unconscious bias? If you're in the public sector, you'll find a whole range of courses on unconscious bias. And yet, it may be that EDIs could be seen as a waste of time and money. Who is daring to suggest that the emperor has got no clothes? Who is daring to suggest that actually there is an alternative to this side of things and maybe an alternative question which can solve racial bias? Well, our awesome guest today, top author Buki Masaku. How are you, Buki?
I'm good. How are you?
Great and wonderful to connect with your good self. I'm fascinated by this particular text that you've produced, I Don't Understand, Navigating Unconscious Bias in the Workplace. I mean, just looking at some of these eye-watering figures that gender-based discrimination costs social institutions on a global basis, $12 trillion. $12 trillion. The US economy, $16 trillion over the last two decades. And in terms of the US economy since 1990, $51 trillion. Those are significant sums. I mean, that's almost as high as Google's profits.
Yeah. Very good analogy. Yeah.
So share with us, I mean, this whole question, I mean, most of us who are around would say, look, the greater diversity, the greater inclusivity, the greater the strength. And yet we still have these issues with respect to unconscious bias, et cetera. Talk to us a little bit about your research in this field and why you came up with the notion of simply saying, I don't understand, could be a solution.
Well, look, you know, I've been consulting in the consulting world for 23 years now, or in my 23rd year. And in that, as a vendor, I was exposed to racial bias. And as a practitioner, developing solutions and workshops to address bias and all forms of unconscious bias, it became very clear to me that not enough attention was allocated to equipping people with skills to navigate what I describe as the inevitability of workplace bias. Now, earlier I said that I was exposed to racial bias. Now, the problem is that, you know, when I say that, people immediately think, oh, bias toward, he's a black guy, it's bias towards him. But actually, sometimes it was my bias towards the majority. And this created a great deal of confusion in my mind. Sometimes I'd sense bias, but then realize I was wrong. But it was too late because internally, I had been cursing out the person that I thought I was on the receiving end of bias. Right. So this created a confusion, which I didn't understand, which was part of the reason for the title of the book. So what I decided to do was go. This led me on a quest to work out how to call out sensed unconscious bias in the moment as and when it happens so that we can navigate it as opposed to trying to eradicate it, which is where the vast majority, I'd say 99.999% of organizations and educational institutions come from in terms of trying to tackle this problem.
I mean, the fascinating thing from somebody who, like myself, has worked in academic circles for the last 30 years is something this has cropped up and clearly it's being addressed. We have, as I think most universities do, EDI officers and so on. Yeah. And that argument that maybe this is counterproductive. Is that something which, again, you're finding is gaining traction? Do you think that in terms of that, you know, simply it's all about communication, that we're not communicating? That's at the heart of the message?
I think you're on the money. The bottom line is it is about communication and it's about honesty, right? That there is a multi-directional nature to workplace bias. In the workplace, what I'm talking about. So outside, that's a different approach. But in the workplace, there's a multidirectional nature. If I sense bias from you towards me based on a decision that you made, right? And I misinterpret an unfavorable decision towards me as driven by unconscious bias, that then becomes my bias. I become the perpetrator and you become the victim in that moment. But traditional views and strategies for tackling workplace bias refuse to allow for that. And in doing that, they have a flawed understanding in terms of what unconscious bias is. And as a result, they come up with the wrong solutions. And what we found is that they tend to subscribe to what I describe as a guilty perpetrator versus hapless victim model. That is, there are these people, they look a certain way, walk and talk in a certain way, they are the guilty perpetrator. And there are these people that look a certain way and walk and talk a certain way, they are the hapless victim. And reality, that's just, in reality, that represents a rudimentary understanding of the interpersonal dynamics of workplace bias. Like I said, there's a multidirectional nature. I told you I could misinterpret your behavior is driven by unconscious bias, then what's my misinterpretation based on? Well, it's based on hearsay, it's based on my past experience, and it's based on a wider narrative about the majority, which I shortcut to, which becomes my bias, right? Likewise, I could be correct, right? I could be correct and I could sense bias. But what that shows us is that it's multidirectional. And once you realize it's multidirectional, then you have to allow the minority and the majority have to allow for that misinterpretation, but still call it out. And in doing that, you're able to recondition the other person. And the way to allow for that misinterpretation and call it out is to simply say, I don't understand. We call that, yeah. Does that make sense?
Human beings have notoriously over the millennia been known for their narrow-mindedness, their tendency to actually associate in tribes, in clans, in groups, whether it's... You know, sporting tribes, whatever, you have this notion. I recall one of the early unconscious bias sessions I actually had, which was basically, how would you react if you're on a train? Would you sit next to the person who was dressed as a punk? Would you sit next to the person who had a small baby, a child? You know, where would you actually choose to sit, etc., if there was only a seat available? And I mean, let's face it, those prejudgments can be impactful, and they can be self-harming as well, because you actually don't open yourself to various other issues. But presumably from that notion of, there are a large number of officers who are entrusted with taking this stage further in all institutions, whether it be broadcasting institutions, academic business institutions, etc. Is it simply a case of that line, I don't understand, which at its heart seems to suggest you need to communicate clearly what the message is, as opposed to saying, as you said, that 360-degree notion of, well, if it's unconscious, how can you ever be conscious of unconscious bias? Isn't that an oxymoron in itself, really?
Yeah. Well, I think, look, you know, that statement, when turned into a question, that is, I don't understand, turned into a question, invokes our natural instinct to give direction. That is, the person will say to you, well, what don't you understand? Or they'll say to you, let me explain, or let me elaborate. And in both situations, you're now into a sticky conversation that you wouldn't have been able to get into about bias. Now, the key is to focus, is to maintain that I don't understand type questioning. And we call that dispassionate developmental inquiry. And when you come from a developmental perspective in trying to address a sensed injustice, what you're going to find is that the person will naturally correct you, not necessarily because they're a nice person, but because it's our instinct to do that. So let me give you an example. If I saw you on the London street and I said, could you, and you were in the city, and I said, and you're familiar with the city, and I just came up to you and I said, could you tell me where Bank Station is? Naturally, most 99% of people go, yeah, go straight down the road, do a left, do a right, right? Because they're responding to developmental inquiry. So what we need to do is equip people with the skills to navigate bias, recognizing that inevitable. And if we can equip people with the skills, then they can navigate it like a slalom skater. And if you follow this process that I've just mentioned, what you're going to find is that one of two things are going to happen. Either the bias towards you will actually call itself out. So you don't have to say you gave the job to her, you didn't give it to me. In the course of this dialogue, it will actually unearth itself. Or what will happen is that your reverse bias will call itself out. And in the and as a result, you can then work with that other person to collaboratively agree next steps in both situations. So the key is engaging in dispassionate developmental inquiry to unearth what the real problem is. But we're not talking. You know, we're not doing what old Bob Hoskins used to say, right? What we do is we tend to go into, when I sense bias from you, for example, I won't tell you because I'm afraid that you might, it might get your back up. So what I do is I look for, I don't say anything to you. I look for somebody like me and I tell them, and I say, these guys, these majority leaders, they're trying to hold us back. And that person typically is like me and maybe has never called somebody out in the way I've suggested. So they go, yeah, that happened to me too. Right? Which reinforces a bias about the majority. But it gets worse. When you sense my, what you believe is my misinterpretation or reverse bias, you don't tell me either because you think that I'll think that you're unsympathetic with the equality cause. But what you then tend to do is later on, you might see somebody who you're comfortable with, who tends to look like you. And you'll say, yeah, look, I really am sympathetic with the equality cause. But some of these minorities misinterpret perfectly normal behavior as unconscious discrimination. And that person will say, yeah, that's happened to me, right? Which then reinforces the bias about the majorities having chip, sorry, the minority having chips on their shoulders. And never the twain shall meet.
I'm mindful of the phrase, perhaps. What is it about unconscious bias that you don't understand? another meta level to actually work through. So, you know, we work on that system. We live in a world, Bookie, where clearly technology is taking an ever-growing role with ChatGPT and so on, and lots of other areas within that. And you spoke about how you would ask somebody, can you guide them to bank station, for instance, in an environment where most folk these days would probably even be very reluctant to ask somebody else because they'd have their GP satellite navigation system there. Is that something else which is going to feed into problems when it comes to unconscious bias? As we become more narrower, you get a kind of echo chamber effect because you're reinforcing your perspectives through social media as opposed to colleagues that you might encounter.
That's such a good point. You know, we're becoming more, ironically, more introverted, right? Even, you know, and we're not having that conversation. So the likelihood of us improving this problem addressing, resolving this problem is significantly reduced unless, you know, we can get this message out. I think it's beholden to leaders to equip their teams, their leadership, their people managers and their staff with the skills to navigate bias so that they can have more high-performing organizations. So I think it's important for leaders to take the role in this. But the problem is the role that leaders are taking at the moment is to say is driven by atonement with the desire to show people that you know we owe you something because we're part of the majority and we're going to do our best to demonstrate that we're all about.
And what you seem to be describing there, Bookie, is something which is often called out using the pejorative term virtue signaling to actually say how much we're actually saying this, how much, oh, the guilt, we have the guilt, but they don't really go down to solve the heart of the problem. Is that also something which is a challenge when it comes to this whole notion that we forget that actually, yeah, you can go back and say, you know, those Romans, they came over here, they invaded the country, they owe us something. What's going on? You know, any of those aspects, is that something, again, we need to really be conscious of?
Yeah, I think you're so right. You know, and the two words that I was struggling to look for were guilt, pain, and retribution. Right? Guilt, pain. There's this. Our strategies or leaders' strategies are based on this kind of guilt, pain, and retribution, and it leads. It doesn't lead to a solution. It leads to a reinforcing of the status quo, and there is a lot of virtual signaling going on, and I think that needs to be called out. And I think, again, I just come back to leadership. Leaders have to transcend the noise, right? Transcend the confusion and focus on the solution. But the problem is that leaders are doing what they shouldn't be doing. They're focusing on the symptoms, not the causes. The symptoms are zero minorities, zero blacks in the black CEOs in the FTSE 100. Those are the symptoms, right? But the causes are a lack of acceptance of the multidirectional nature of the bias that causes the underrepresentation in these roles. Once we accept that, then we can address it. But because people are so afraid to address it and so desperate to show that they're not guilty, we're not part of those bad people, we're different, they're actually reinforcing that they, as a majority, are actually the guilty perpetrator. When in reality, it's fluid. In the moment, I, as we saw at the top of this, I could be guilty of bias, regardless of your position towards you, and you could be guilty of bias towards me.
Put quite simply, I'm wearing a tie, you're not wearing a tie. Does that mean that we're prejudiced against people who are tie wearers or not tie wearers? It's as ludicrous as that, perhaps. We're coming to the end of what I think is a fascinating insight, but I mean, just to go back to the kind of drilling down in terms of this research, you interviewed more than 40,000 people over a period of more than 20 years, and again, designed to determine the extent of racial bias faced by Black, Asian, minority ethnic citizens. I'm just fascinated, Bookie, because I've also heard the line, as I'm sure you have yourself, that even using the term BAME can actually be seen as a prejudicial approach. And there are certain folk who would actually say, don't refer to me as that. I don't want to be labeled.
Yeah. So actually, I actually concur with that. And, but the research was done at a time when that was the word that people were using, or the acronym. But to be honest, it does put people it doesn't recognize individual differences or differences across all each of those groups. So probably that's the one good thing. I don't want to get political, but that's the one good thing that Boris and his people did, is to say that we should stop using that term, because I think it's not, it's kind of lumping people.
They had to say something good after all the parties they were having. So let's just have a light on that. It's a different issue entirely. The book itself is called I Don't Understand, Navigating Unconscious Bias in the Workplace. Of course, Bookie Massacco is the author. It's available now. You can access it in all sorts of ways. Bookie, it's been awesome connecting with a good self. I've got two final questions. These are always the toughies. First of all, have you had a reasonably interesting Zoomer with us on the program today? Has it been good for you?
Of course, yeah, because you've been asking me very intelligent questions, and that's really important for me. Very important, yeah.
The next critical question is, will you be kind enough to return? Can we prevail upon you to join us in the not-too-distant future and keep us appraised of your views on the silver bullets for racial bias? Simply, I don't understand.
Yes, definitely. It would be my pleasure.
It's a sobering thought that almost a fifth of British folk are having to dip into their savings every week, and the whole notion of actually putting 10% to one side, and the traditional notion as probably having to take second place to things like household bills, possibly even medication, according to a new study by online savings provider Ford Money. So to address this challenging situation, maybe address ways in which we can still continue to save, we're very delighted to welcome two fabulous individuals. First of all, the author of Money Talks and the founder of the This Girl Talks Money. That's Ellie Austin Williams. How are you, Ellie?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. And we've also got the Chief Deposits Officer at Ford Money. That's Will Davis. How are you, Will?
I'm excellent. Thank you, Alex.
Okay, Will, have you noticed a reduction in the amounts that people are actually saving? Or is it a case of, well, there's no reduction, but there's an awful lot more withdrawals going on?
So it's more the latter. So we're seeing we're in this weird place at the moment where, obviously the economic situation is what it is, and we all know what's going on there. We're seeing at the beginning of every month people plowing money into their savings accounts, really good intentions to be able to see themselves throughout the month with as much savings as possible. But then as we get towards the end of the month, you're seeing people kind of drip feeding from their savings balances, taking more and more withdrawals, presumably because they're seeing large bills at the end of the month or kind of an increase in their mortgage rate, whatever it may be. And then they're depleting their savings within kind of 20, 25 days of putting their initial deposit in.
Ellie, is this a case of the money not so much talking as squealing, saying, please leave me be, let me be, don't take me out again, or something along those sort of lines, Ellie? I mean, what is this situation from your own perspective?
Yeah, so I completely can see what is going on here. I think one of the big things that this research has revealed from Fraud Money is that people have got these expectations about what they should be saving. So these high savings expectations are putting a lot of pressure on people to save more than they can maybe maintain, and it's leading to these unstable habits. And I'm a big believer that when it comes to money and to looking after our financial well-being, that having habits that you can sustain and that you can build on over time is what is so important. However, what we're seeing here is actually the opposite of that, and that people are, like Will said, putting a lot of money in at the start of the month and then withdrawing it rather than actually thinking, what is a realistic, sustainable amount of money that I can save? And sometimes that requires you to, take a step back and reset your expectations. But with so many different pressures coming from different directions at the moment, then that is not at all a bad thing to do. I think it's a really helpful thing to do for your long-term financial outlook, is to reassess where you are and to not keep putting on more and more pressure to reach a goal that maybe just isn't sustainable now.
So perhaps being realistic in terms of what we're looking to save is perhaps the key way forward. Is tithing, i.e. that 10% of monthly income, is that still a good target to those who actually have, assuming one can look to at least put something into the savings pot?
If you can do
Yeah.
10%, then great. Absolutely. Sorry, Ellie. Sorry to jump in. Personally, my view is you should always be a little bit dynamic with your savings. Some months you're going to have more expensive months than other months. You might have to, you might have a big bill that you've got to pay in your house, or your mortgage rate might have changed, or you may have just been on holiday. So don't be afraid of saying, well, actually, I'm going to put a little bit less in this month, even none at all this month,
So
so that you.
flexibility, basically, Will and Ellie, is key
Absolutely.
to the whole system. I mean, just going back to yourself, Ellie, I'm always a great believer in that notion of you're really looking to ensure that, in the old classic Mr. Micawber fashion, you actually are slightly ahead of the game. So it's just saving little and often is better than kind of sharp decisions one way or the other through the course of the year.
Absolutely. Absolutely, I'm with you 100% there. I think it really is. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Everything with money and savings and, whatever it is that you're working towards financially, then unless you win the lottery, there are not quick fixes. Money is not something where, you can do a crash course or a crash diet. It's something that requires time, it requires care, it requires those small incremental habits day on day, month on month. And so that finding that level where you can keep up that saving habit is going to not only help you to actually achieve it, but it's going to help you feel more motivated as well. Because I don't know about you, but there's nothing that is less motivating than that yo-yo feeling of like making progress and then going backwards if you have to dip into your savings. So it's about the mindset as well around the saving.
Will, talking about mindsets, is it also important that people, savers in particular, provide themselves with sufficient information and knowledge to actually know where the best and most efficient option of actually putting their money in can be developed? I mean, looking at Ford Money, obviously, is one example, but there are notorious cases of banks that effectively say, oh, we're just not going to pass on this interest rise to savers. We're just going to step aside and avoid that.
Yeah, that's right. And it's a bit of a shame in the market, really, because a lot of banks do make it a little bit complicated. And as you say, you can see these teaser rates out there. You put your money into one account, you think, oh, that's great, I've got the best interest rate available. But then you look 3 months later and you're either your interest rate has been reduced, or they've offered higher interest rates to other customers. So actually you're sat in a fairly average account when other people are earning a lot more than you. And I guess at Ford Money, what we try to do is not do that kind of thing. We have a long-term value proposition where we offer everyone the best rate that's available at any given time. So that if you're a customer that joined us 6 years ago, or you're a customer that joined us today, you will get the same interest rate and it will be one of the best interest rates available in the market.
And where can people find out more details about Ford Money and the kind of services that you offer, Will?
Fordmoney.co.uk will have all of the information fairly simply laid out for anybody who wants to know about our
And
savings accounts.
for people, Ellie, who wish to follow through the language of money, whatever it's sort of speaking to us about, and indeed This Girl Talks Money, where can they locate your good self?
Absolutely. So, thisgirltalksmoney.com and on Instagram, on social media, at This Girl Talks Money.
Ellie Austin Williams, founder, of course, of This Girl Talks Money. And she does, of course, very sensible as well. And Will Davis, Chief Deposits Officer at Ford Money. Many thanks indeed. And keep on saving, folks.
Thank you, Alex.
Thanks.
Nobody likes to be the victim of fraud, and certainly nobody would like to be the victim of a smishing scam, especially if you've got other stresses and strains to actually cope with, such as maybe starting a new academic year, maybe you're heading to a university, a college, and so on. What are the challenges that you're going to be faced with respect to finances and so on? Well, delighted to actually welcome somebody who can provide you with some very important advice if you happen to either know somebody who is going to university or indeed are a student yourself, to actually cope with avoiding fraud, certainly online and more. We have the risk director of the Student Loans Company. That's Alan Balanowski with us. How are you, Alan?
Good morning, Alex. Yes, I'm great. Thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Excellent. Now, as I say, over the next few weeks, over £2 billion will be paid to students, which is a significant sum in all sorts of ways from that point of view. So let's talk about how to avoid any of that £2 billion that's going to students going to the criminal element and actually taking on board issues relating to how do they protect themselves. Is it a case of, well, don't send to any emails who purport to actually have your Nigerian bank details?
Yeah, again, thanks, Alex. I think just important, what is a really exciting time for lots of students as they return to university or start university, we are reminding them to look out for scammers. So as you've already highlighted, we make roughly 2.3 billion payments to more than 1 million students as they start and return to university. But we also see an increase in scams, fraudsters trying to intercept those first maintenance payments. So really, really important that we work together to identify the scams, identify what ways they're operating. And today we're really sharing our top tips to help students and their parents and sponsors to look out for.
Fraud is in itself becoming much more sophisticated. And I used a very crass example at the start there. I mean, those days have long since gone. I mean, there are email messages that one is sent, text messages, which have the veneer of truthfulness about them, but are anything but. So how can people actually beware that they don't actually suddenly inadvertently become a fraud victim?
Yeah, so there's a few things we want to highlight today. So first and foremost, think before you click. Be suspicious of any links in text messages. Hover over the text message themselves to see where is it going. If it's not going to a gov.uk address, it's not going to be from us. We would never use WhatsApp, and we would never initiate contact via a social media channel. Look out for bad grammar, poor spelling, weird spacing in messages, and poor punctuation as well. Typically, these scams, particularly if they're sent out in text messages, and we're anticipating quite a lot of text messages this year, they tend to be entitled Dear Student. So it's unlikely they would actually be personalised to the individual student themselves. And we would never also add a sense of urgency to our communication to students. We would never say you must respond within a certain period. That just won't be from us. There will be lots of comms coming up from us to students as we approach the payment date, just to remind people to check that we have the correct details for them. And importantly, we will advise students if their bank details have changed. So if they notice that they get a message from us saying that the bank details have changed, really important they log on to their account to double check that we have the correct details.
So the message basically, Alan, is to check, check in, check again, basically. And presumably, if in doubt, contact the Student Loans Company directly.
Correct. My team is here to help. You can contact us at the following email address, which is fcpu_alerts@slc.co.uk. You'll find all this information and more on our website, which is gov.uk/slc. But the main message today, Alex, is really think before you click.
And if you're asked to update your bank details and so on, clearly be very, very wary from that point of view. Alan, again, it's a whole new world in which we're entering, etc. Do you feel as though through interviews like this, the message is getting across and that the fraudsters will lose in the end?
I think it's important that we keep the momentum going. The fraudsters will always try and pivot and attempt to do something else. So that's why that working together is really, really important. The students will see the threats sometimes before we do. So let us know what's happening and we can respond quickly together.
Alan Balanowski, Risk Director of the Student Loans Company. Many thanks indeed, and keep up the excellent work.
Thanks, Alex.
Well, we are in the autumn, and clearly we might be thinking about our little cave, our little part of the world that we have as our homes, etc. What about some of those issues in terms of how can we create a happy home? How can we obviously ensure that maybe our home reflects our balanced mental health or indeed helps our mental health? Well, we're delighted to welcome to the programme no less a personage than interior design guru extraordinaire and indeed host of BBC's Interior Design Masters. It's the fabulous Michelle Ogadain. How are you, Michelle?
I'm great. Thank you. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Well, it's delighted to connect with your good self. And is it a case of, you know, those simple changes which might not cost too much can make such an impact on our particular well-being and sense of place in the world?
Oh, I really, really do believe they can, because when we talk about well-being, we often talk about nutrition or exercise or the importance of sleep, maybe meditation or yoga, all with good intent. But we often forget to talk about our environment, which is, you know, by which I mean the space that surrounds us and the impact that that has on you, because it's a very real and very strong impact. I mean, there's even scientific data that says that what surrounds you has more ability to predict your kind of predilection to fall ill than genetics. So it is not something that I want us to overlook. And so I'm very much on a mission to help people harness that power for their health and happiness.
Well, this is, of course, very true, because a third of families in this research say that their home doesn't provide the right kind of positive backdrop to block out the negativity for their families. Now, Lord knows we have enough negativity going on in the world outside without actually bringing it into the house. Is this simply a case of, you know, we need to look at ensuring we don't overclutter, we actually have a good clear out, or is it just a case of colour schemes? How do we go about this?
Well, there's so much in that. I mean, and I think this research from Graham and Brown really does sort of underline what you said. I mean, there's a lot going on out there, which means that our little curated corner of the world, that space that we can call private and home, becomes so important. But then what I hear in the data is the recognition of the potential of home. So it is people recognizing that actually that space that surrounds us can give us the uplift that we crave. And you're absolutely right, Alex. It starts with decluttering. And that isn't about kind of creating a space that's all terribly zen with just one single pot, just so, and a single cacti. It's about making sure that the things that surround you are things that actually represent you. So they're not the broken things. They're not the dribbly pot. They're not the gift that you were given by like Auntie Flossie that you've never really liked, but you still put on the shelf, because every time you look at it, you'll just be thinking, oh, I really don't like that. It's about having those things around you that give you positive memories. So it's not about not having stuff. I love stuff, but I would like you to contain your stuff. So a floating shelf is always a big thing in my life.
Be it ever so humble, there's no place like home. Or indeed, as Dorothy said in The Wizard of Oz, there's no place like home. Several times, in fact, as she clicked her heels together. I mean, is this something which it has to be very much bespoke to individuals? I mean, we talk about the family, of course. Families are equally unique in a whole variety of ways. But does each person need to find their own particular safe space and happy space for their own emotional well-being?
Well, I agree. It is one of the hardest things within a family to kind of find that space where you can unite all your tastes. And I would say that the living room is that space where you hopefully can celebrate the different characters that are sharing a home. But it's also important that whatever space that we allow our children to occupy, that they're allowed to play as well and to choose the colours for their room or choose the wallpaper themselves, so that they feel that they have some sense of control over their environment. And they've created that, like, I love that you used the word earlier, the den for them. I mean, there's a reason that we like dens. We want to feel safe. We want to feel cozy. But it is about just kind of allowing yourself to be you. So if your thing is purple polka dots, go for it. Because why should anyone else tell you what to do in your home? I really want that sense that when you cross your threshold, your shoulders drop and you just think, okay, I'm here. I'm home. I'm safe. I made it through another day. This is my space where it's okay to be me.
You're far too young to remember where the height of sophistication in certain instances could be seen as three ducks positioned flying up a wall somewhere, a bit like Hilda Ogden, who used to have in Coronation Street. But in terms of that, do you feel as though we have moved on? And obviously, as design has evolved as well, people have actually also perhaps they're approaching a balance between the sterile nature of the silver world of the 21st century, which we were promised, and maybe, as we said before, the clutter of Victorian bric-a-brac.
No, I think you're right. I think we're actually in an era where people are less and less afraid to express their individuality. And, you know, we saw that also through lockdown as well, where suddenly you can just think, you know what, actually, I hate this wall. I hate this colour. I'm just going to do something bonkers that I love. And so I think we're seeing that more confidence, actually, to just have a go and to recognise that if you put that paper up and then you think, actually, maybe that wasn't the greatest thing, it's actually just as easy to take it down. But it's also, I mean, one of the phrases that's around at the moment is that idea of dopamine decor. Have you heard that at all?
I'm not sure in terms of, say, if you take it literally, well, it's a good idea. But I suppose if it gives you that feel-good hit that dopamine does after exercise, maybe it could be useful.
Exactly. It's about tying into that idea that the part of the brain that processes colour is the same part that processes our emotions. So we understand then that when we're looking at colour and texture and pattern, that it affects us emotionally and physically. So it's a cocktail of joy in the interior design toolbox. And I think there's also a very strong sense that once you take charge of your space, whether that is clearing out the clutter or deciding that you're going to go leopard skin on the walls, it is a step towards taking charge of yourself as well. It's just a little way to just think, OK, I actually have more control in this crazy world than perhaps I originally thought I did.
Although I have to say, I draw the line at leopard skin on the walls. I'm sorry, that's a deal breaker, Michelle. So I'm not going to go down that line in any way, shape or form. Where can people find out further information about the sort of things we've been discussing today, Michelle?
Well, I mean, it's International Wallpaper Week, which was founded by Graham and Brown. So there's loads of inspiration and information on their website, which is grahamandbrown.com. So I would absolutely advise people to go and look there. And if I may be so bold as well, I even wrote a book on the subject, Happy Inside, How to Harness the Power of Home for Health and Happiness. So I'd like to think there's quite a few tips and tricks in there too.
Absolutely. And in addition, of course, to hosting BBC's Interior Design Masters, can people follow you on the various socials, Michelle?
Oh, yes. You can just find me just by looking up my name. Instagram is my kind of social of choice. I'm afraid I'm not doing any of the other ones.
No, I think TikTok, again, probably has the same sort of impact on me as leopard skin on the wall. Just step away from that whole thing. It's just not on, really. Anyway, for the moment, Michelle Gundahin, many thanks indeed. Take care and happy design issues.
Thank you. Same to you. But go for that leopard skin. You might love it.
Oh, Michelle, no, it's just not going to happen. I'm sorry. I think without going down the line of virtue signalling, most of us actually want to ensure that we're doing as best as we can what's best for the planet. And clearly that also includes looking at alternative energy sources as well. So we're delighted to actually welcome two fine folk to maybe give us their take on ways in which we can maybe actually look at more greener alternatives. First of all, the head of heat at OVO Energy, that's Gráinne Reagan. How are you, Gráinne?
Very well, thank you.
And we've also got the founder of The Heat Geek, that's Adam Chapman. How are you, Adam?
I'm very well, thank you.
Okay, let's turn to you first, Gráinne. I mean, clearly the heat is on, no pun intended, but in terms of the way in which we cope with energy bills, increasing rises, etc., are we over the worst? Is it just the beginning of the end of civilization? Are we in a sea change? What's your take in terms of how households are looking forward to coping with winter costs this year?
Well, hopefully it's not the end of civilization, but certainly I think things have to change. So as you've said, energy bills have been sky high for the past couple of years now. And this winter, even though costs have come down slightly, the government have stopped with the support scheme that they've been running for the last kind of 2 years. So energy bills are probably for most people going to remain at a similar level to what they have been. What's a longer term solution here? How do we actually get energy bills down, across the board in a way that's sustainable? And the answer is moving to greener solutions within our homes. Heating is one of the biggest costs that most households will incur. It's also responsible for 11% of greenhouse gas emissions across the UK. And so it's a clear, obvious place to start when you're thinking about how do I bring my costs down and how do I make my property greener? Heat pumps are a brilliant solution for customers who want to make that switch. And when you combine a heat pump that's been installed well with a heat pump tariff, such as Heat Pump Plus, which OBO have launched today, you can save up to £500 a year on your heating, which is really going to help people and make it more palatable, I suppose, to switch away from gas boilers to heat pumps.
Adam, there are clearly issues politically relating to how we actually pursue the net zero agenda, as it's referred to. I mean, one presumes, as founder of the Heat Geek, you're also keen to support Grainne's position and also the way in which we can actually look at greener alternatives to keeping ourselves warm.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're product agnostic, really, but when it comes to efficiency and lowering primary energy use, there isn't really a greater appliance out there than a heat pump. So, yeah, we're absolutely in support of them. And a lot of our training is based around that. But as Grainne said, they do have to be installed properly. And that's kind of what Heat Geek do. We're a network of very, very geeky, nerdy engineers who love the finer points of heating and are up till stupid o'clock in the morning talking about that on the internet. And that's how you irk out like, the most efficiency out of these units. And if you do, you can get, you know, really, really great savings every single year in your back pocket to reward you for doing the right thing.
And Grainne, Adam raised a very important point there about ensuring it's installed properly. Are there sufficiently qualified and indeed registered souls who will actually install the heat pump in a way which actually won't necessarily result in challenges and constant sort of breaking down and such like?
Absolutely. There's, you know, over 180,000 engineers out there. And as long as they have the right training, such as that offered by HeatGeek, you know, it's a relatively simple install. The reason OVO have partnered with HeatGeek is because they've led the way in setting the standard for training across heating engineers. So that's why we're kind of happy to work with them to make sure that customers are getting the best, most efficient installations within their properties. So certainly that training piece is key. And that's why HeatGeek are kind of, you know, leading the way and partnered with OVO on this.
The likelihood, Adam, is that within the next 12 to 18 months, there will be a general election. Things will change from that point of view. Do you feel as though it's very much just a final crapshoot as far as the government are concerned in terms of saying, oh, we'll just postpone this, we'll adjust this? Or do you think politically there are any long-term trends to be seen here?
I mean, because it goes against everything everyone's been saying for the last decade. Yeah, obviously it's making some noise. It would be my personal opinion. But at the moment, we do need less noise and more strong leadership. It's sending a confusing message to people that are trying to do the right thing. So not the right noise at the right time, really, from a environmental standpoint.
And I suppose he's saying that there was a decision to increase the government BUS grant for heat pumps up to 7,500. But even that suggests that a number of people are still not necessarily keen to effectively go for this. So there's quite a lot of misconceptions around. I mean, Grainne, through features such as this, do you feel as though we're getting there, or is it just a case of, no, we've got a long way to go?
I think there's a long way to go, but things are moving in the right direction. So you're absolutely right when you say that there's a lot of myths out there amongst customers and within the industry as well about heat pumps and how they work and, you know, are they right for me? So that's why it's up to, you know, industry players like OVO and HeatGeek to make sure that customers have the right information there to dispel some of these myths and to put the products out there that make heat pumps the right decision for people. I think there's more that the government can do as well. So clearly, as you mentioned, there's funding available. So £7,500 off the cost of an install, which is great. But we need more. So at the moment, it can be quite difficult for individuals to get the planning that they need to have a heat pump installed. So making changes to these planning restrictions is absolutely necessary. We also need more green energy on the grid. So you know, a heat pump is only as green as the electricity that's going into it. So more renewable generation will make sure that these heat pumps are as green as they can be, and will also reduce our reliance on gas, which should in the longer term bring those energy bills down.
And where can people find out more about OVO Energy, Branya?
So they can go to our website at ovoenergy.com. And if they search heat pumps, they can find out more about this offer and the work that we're doing together with HeatGeek.
And likewise, HeatGeek, Adam, is there a go-to site for that as well?
Yeah, heatgeek.com, or there's lots of consumer advice on our YouTube channel to help consumers sort of find their way through this kind of potentially complicated process of decarbonising their homes.
Adam Chapman, founder of the HeatGeek, and Grania Reagan, head of heat at OVO Energy. Stay warm, people.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Well, it's a fact of the life and human experience that if you don't use it, you will lose it. And that can certainly be said with respect to local restaurants as well. Such an important part of our lives. And yet, clearly, many of us don't actually take up the opportunity of actually appreciating them and so on. However, maybe that's changing. In 2022, there were over 150,000 restaurants in the UK, which was an increase of 8% on 2019. So good news there. And why are restaurants such an important part of our community, with two-thirds of people actually believing that local places to eat are important in building a sense of community? Well, we've got two fabulous folk to actually talk about with respect to this report. First of all, the Senior Vice President of International Growth at Open Table. That's Robin Chiang. How are you, Robin?
Nice to meet you.
Excellent. Good to connect with your good self. And we've also got a practitioner with respect to the restaurant business itself. Of course, that's Fraser from Angels with Bagpipes. How are you, Fraser?
I'm good, thanks, Alex. How are you?
Excellent. And I'm presuming, given the title Angels with Bagpipes, you're not based in the joys of Assassinat country, are you?
No, we're on the Royal Mile in Edinburgh.
Exactly. Just want to make that quite clear. No, of course, we're all one United Kingdom, and that's the important thing about this. So it's great to hear with respect to that. Robin, let's turn to you first. I mean, were you surprised by this particular area? Because, I mean, there have been a number of challenging years in the industry. And as I said at the start, you know, this tendency that we actually have to say, OK, well, we can't go out to dine, it's too expensive, or all sorts of other excuses. You know, maybe are we turning the corner?
Well, we definitely weren't surprised. You know, at Open Table, we're obsessed with restaurants and are in awe of all the things that great restaurateurs do. Like, basically, you know, what Fraser does at Angels with Bagpipes, it's fantastic that they're going day in, day out. And for us, restaurants have bounced back strongly with the support of the dining public since the pandemic. But the longer-term stuff, the ability to build a sense of community and improving personal well-being, that we always knew, because we're in and out of restaurants every day at Open Table. So for me, that is, you know, what came through in the report, and we really wanted to showcase that here.
Fraser, I'm looking at the data here from opentable.co.uk, and I'm seeing that Edinburgh is very much up there as a place where there are the most explorative diners. Effectively, Edinburgh residents are prepared to travel the longest to reach their favourite restaurants, travelling up to 40 minutes to get to Edinburgh. I mean, is that because, well, of course, when you do that, you expect to have some angels with bagpipes performing for you.
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible stat, actually, but it's not one I'm really surprised by. You know, I live in East Lothian, and, you know, we need to travel 40 minutes to get to Edinburgh. You know, I myself have travelled to London just to eat in a restaurant because of what they offer and the different experiences that you get.
Well, London has, interestingly, the most diverse dining scene, which I suppose you might say, yeah, that's okay. I mean, I would have thought Edinburgh should be coming a close second to that. Or is it a case of, no, we prefer to actually keep our haggis pure?
No, I don't think so. I think there's so many different cuisines in Edinburgh now that you know, you don't have to have your traditional Scottish. We're on the Royal Mile, obviously, so there's an aspect of that has to be in the menu. But there's a very diverse range of restaurants in Edinburgh now.
Close by to Lincoln, of course, Sheffield, well, not too far away, the most affordable dining city, Robin. You averaged just under £25. Well, actually, you're fair enough, £24.56. I mean, a bargain for Sheffield residents. Do you think that's going to be rolled out across the country?
Look, I think there's, you know, UK has been fantastic. So I moved here in 2019. I'm originally Australian. There's a whole range in of different cuisines and price points all across the UK. And as Fraser said, you know, just within the Royal Mile, there's a whole range of price points and cuisines just there. And that for us is what we want to celebrate. And you can see, we highlighted four of them in the Open Table report. So those are interested, it's called the Open Table Restaurant Impact Report. And that's diversity that we see across the UK. But like, you know, I think that the dining scene everywhere is really interesting, up and down, sort of from fine dining all the way to your local joints.
Yeah, I was quite intrigued to see that the most regular diners are actually found in the city of Liverpool. 70% of Liverpudlians dining twice or more in 1 week. I mean, I'm curious. I don't know, for some reason, I thought it might have been Newcastle or Manchester, but you know, there we are. Just goes to show my predictions. Serious note, Robin, I mean, actually dining out can actually help our well-being, our personal well-being and so on. And interesting enough, a third of British folk surveyed agreed that local restaurants, pubs and cafes or add value to their well-being. Sometimes we tend to forget that. I mean, it is important that, you know, the sense of going out, not just for the theatre and so on, but going to the restaurant afterwards or before is significant.
Yeah, it's the chance to gather, whether that's with your loved one, your family, friends, and even with colleagues, and sometimes with strangers, you know, that's builds a sense of community and sense of personal well-being. And I think 15% of people across the UK, when they walk into their local hospitality venue, they expect it to be called or frequently called by their first name. And for me, I travel a lot internationally. When I come home back to London, I walked into my local restaurant and they greet me with, "Oh, welcome back, Robin." And that for me has a real sense of coming home. So I totally understand that improving personal well-being, building sense of community and all that we highlight in the report. And it's from like great restaurateurs, like once again, like Fraser, that really makes like the whole experience when I'm dining out fantastic. It's the great food, but also the great hospitality.
Fraser, is this something that connects with yourself in Edinburgh? Do you always make sure that you recognize your customers, even the ones who you might have found quite challenging? Because let's face it, sometimes customers can be a tiny bit challenging when they insist on various aspects that aren't on the menu.
Yeah, I think it's one of the things that we really focus on here. We have maybe cocktails that are off the menu now and people like them and they'll ask for them. And, you know, it's something that we want to be personal with, you know, as a business, and make sure that people that have come before will get the same experience the next time. And we really try and focus on the people and, you know, certainly the returning customers. The difficult ones, yeah, I mean, it's our job and the front house guy's job to make them feel at ease as well and make sure that we're doing everything that we can. And using Open Table is a great way of creating notes and different things like that so that we can recognise that and we know what our customers are needing and what they're wanting, even if there's a new member of staff on or something like that.
Robin, returning back to yourself, as you mentioned, you're from Australia, known, of course, for its sense of hospitality and so on. In Britain, do we compare favourably with Australia? Or is it a case of, I don't know, we've got a long, long way to go in Britain before we start getting the levels of friendliness that you get in Sydney or indeed Melbourne?
I travel a lot in the US as well. And I think for the restaurant industry, one thing that everyone has in common is the hospitality. I think what you remember about a restaurant, you do sometimes remember the food, but more importantly, you remember how you feel. And that's the whole experience. And, you know, what we highlight a restaurant that's not too far from where I live in Angel called Jam Delish. The proprietor there is called Jordan Johnson. And that's like a fantastic restaurant, Caribbean vegan. not the typical type of my everyday place, but like it's incredible hospitality, incredible food, and it's a mix of locals and first timers in there. So I think restaurant industry across all of Open Table's 55,000 restaurants, it's all about hospitality and making people feel great and having great food as well.
And as we said at the start of the piece, make sure that you actually do use those facilities and continue to actually support the area. Let's turn finally back to Fraser. Fraser, people actually want to locate you on the Royal Mile. They're thinking of booking ahead. Clearly, your media profile is being ramped up on this sort of basis. How many months ahead do they need to book?
We're actually fairly lucky that you could get in mostly Saturdays a couple of weeks in advance, but during the week we've got plenty of seats, so we managed to keep some tables spare anyway, just in case of the off chance of some regulars or some people out of town that are looking for something a wee bit different.
Excellent. And do you have a website you'd like to promote as well for Angels with Bagpipes?
Yeah, so that's www.angelswithbagpipes.co.uk.
Fantastic. And back to yourself, Robin, in terms of people wanting to find out more details about Open Table and the report and such like, where would you suggest they should go?
Just search for Open Table Restaurant Impact Report. That should pop up in your search.
Fantastic. Robin Chang, SVP of International Growth at Open Table. And of course, Fraser from Angels with Tables. I won't say happy eating, but I'll say happy restaurant experiencing, gentlemen. Keep on keeping on.
Thanks for having us.